I'm Chris.
And I'm Owen.
And this is the Dead Wargamer Society.
So, thank you, listeners, for tuning in again. Today, we have a very special guest coming back to us, one Mr. Brian C.P. Steele. You might recognize him from our episode on Warzone. He's come back to us to talk to us about one of our favorite games, Dark Age. So please welcome Brian C.P. Steele. Brian?
Insert soundbite. Round of applause. Hi, everybody.
I like how Brian just brings the studio audience with him.
Well, it's part of my contract.
So, Brian, what have you been up to hobby-wise?
Hobby-wise, I actually just started putting together models for a new game that I have yet to play. I've read through the rules, and I've watched a couple of videos, and it seems like a pretty neat game. You may have heard of it. It is called Conquest, The Last Argument of Kings, by Parabellum, a Greek studio that puts together some really cool models. They're gorgeous. And my friends over at Turbo Dork, the paint company, they did a little collaboration box with them that was a handful of paints and one of their models, this big, like, fiery golem thing from the dwarves, the Dwigum, which is actually the faction that I was looking at when I started looking at it a couple of, like, a year ago. And so I got a hold of my buddies at Turbo Dork, and I was like, that's really cool that you guys are doing this paint thing. How much would something like that cost little old me if I kind of ordered it on the sneak? Again, always trying to get those percentage points off. And he actually was like, you know, I've got one sitting right here. As long as you record yourself painting it, here you go. And so that was my first Dwigum miniature was on its way. And the internet bug got me, and I started looking in deeper and dove deeper into finding other models from that line that I liked. And now I'm sitting on like 1500 points worth of Dwigum unpainted and assembled staring at me because still in a pandemic and I haven't had my vaccine yet, so I'm not ready to go out and play just yet, but soon it will happen.
Are you guys rolling towards getting like general population vaccines in Indiana?
Monday. Nice. Next Monday is the general pop. I was part of the last window before they kind of just opened the floodgates. I was able to schedule mine earlier this week, but my actual schedule, because I was part of apparently the largest demographic of people that were waiting to hit that button, I actually don't get mine until April 23rd. So I'm a ways off, but apparently if something opens up before then, they're supposed to call me or something. Nice. So I'm scheduled. I know when it's going to happen. I know there will be a dose waiting for me if I have to wait that long.
Hey, right on. The end's in sight, at least.
And then everything else I've been doing has been a little bit of role-playing and a lot of working. That's about it.
Nice. Chris, what have you been up to, man?
Well, mostly your fault, but I've been working on Confrontation lately. My order came in probably about 2 weeks ago, so I've been working on Wolfen for myself. Mm-hmm. Trying out like a color scheme that I really haven't played with before, usually because I don't do much with whites or yellows. So I have a white, yellow, and blue kind of color scheme that I'm going with, painting the wolves like Arctic wolves. It's pretty neat. It's fun to try something a little bit different. And I've been toying around a lot in Hero Forge lately. They had a sale. So between filling in some models for Dead War games that I have not been able to find to just get that like the right proxy model for it, and adding in just some fun joking stuff while the sale was going, that's a little bit of what I've been working on. What about you?
I've also been working on some Confrontation stuff. I've got my Tyranibor I pulled out of my closet and been painting that. I've been practicing some non-metallic metal, and they're a good opportunity to practice kind of every flavor of non-metallic metal, so iron, gold, copper. Been trying to paint them to a higher standard than I normally do for tabletop, so that's just been kind of a fun way to flex a little bit of those muscles, but would like to start playing some games again soon. And while the dwarfs are definitely fun to paint, I don't know that they're necessarily my play style, so I did actually order a few things off eBay. So I've got some good models for a Codwallon army under the Ferryman's Guild. So got some Griffin models for proxies there, and then just some of the standard Codwallon characters. So looking forward to putting that together, and should have that together in the next probably 2 months, which will be nice. I should actually be fully immunized by the beginning of May. I got my second shot in the middle of April, so 2 weeks plus that. So yeah, it'll be nice to actually feel safe going out into the world and playing some games. So just looking forward to kind of the light at the end of the tunnel there.
Yeah, I think it's really good. You know, Adepticon just posted up their dates that they have intended for 2022. I have high hopes of what can come out of that. You know, Warfare Weekend seems like they're looking to go on in November this year. So if a lot of these, you know, vaccines keep going out there, gamers keep being safe in the meantime, the idea of getting back to cons is a huge motivator and really exciting.
Actually, a little bit even before those, I think October would be the time frame for Dragonfall in Illinois. Brian, I know you've been to that con before. Is that on your radar for this year?
Right now, combination of familial stuff and just honestly so many irons in the fire work-wise, unless I get a green light from a company that wants me at a convention, I'm probably going to generally avoid them. Combination of the you know, it's still a little early for me to go diving in virus happy, vaccination or not. Sadly, there are too many people out there that are obstinate and refuse to decide whether or not this is a bad thing. I kind of want to get a little more distance between, everybody being vaccinated, or as many as possible anyway, but also some of the smaller conventions I would love to go to, but they cost money that I have to make.
I totally understand.
Right now the big one that's up in the air is the hybrid Gen Con that they're talking about in September. I've already had a couple of companies come up to me and ask me whether or not I was going to be there, whether or not I could be there with them. So I don't know. I'll be vaccinated double over by that point. And I'll follow all the safety precautions and things, but it just kind of comes down to what is the best option for me at that time.
Yeah, I totally understand. I mean, it seems like there's some initial evidence that being vaccinated also prevents you from being a carrier of the virus. I stand with you in wanting to see more data on that. We have a single data point, so it'll be interesting to see. Hopefully we keep getting information that reinforces that. And I know, at least for me, that would definitely reduce my anxiety around being in large crowds.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it is. Is that, you know, I don't want to sound all egotistical or, you know, God's forbid, like some of the idiots that get in front of microphones, but I'm not actually terribly afraid of the virus itself. At this point, you know, like, I'm willing to bet that I've probably come in contact with it. I've probably brushed, you know, had my brush with the Rona monster, but there are people in my life that I am not willing to play bridge for, you know, like if even if I myself am not worried about the it hitting me real hard, I am very concerned for my son and stepdaughter. I'm very concerned for my wife. You know, like there are other people that I don't know if I'm ready to pull the trigger on until we see more data, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's a very sane way to approach it. And, you know, I'm looking forward to Dragonfall. I will have no complaints and will fully understand if I have to go to Dragonfall in a mask and present some sort of proof that I'm not COVID positive. I think that would be, I can see several situations where that's just kind of a cost of doing business for it. And I wouldn't begrudge anyone if that's the case. At the same time, if we have data that shows, hey, if you can prove you're vaccinated, you're extremely low risk, let's just go for it. Hey, awesome. Great. But we'll cross that bridge when we get there. And as much as I want to play games, I also, you know, don't want to risk the lives of people around me just because I want to do that. So we will get there, light at the end of the tunnel, and yeah. But in happier news, the reason we brought you on was to talk about your time working on the game Dark Age. So just for people that are totally unfamiliar with your history with the game, how did you initially get into Dark Age and start working on Dark Age?
My initial tenure with Dark Age came as a side effect of being hired as a marketing voice for Cool Money or Not.
Nice.
Originally, I applied to do game writing and design stuff because that's what I had been doing for a long time for like Privateer and everybody. But the one of the owners at the time was I must have just caught him at the right day or whatever. And he specifically, I remember the phone call because I kind of hung up the call and looked at my now ex-wife. I looked at her and was like, I think my boss might like me. because what I was told, you know, we had this big long conversation, and the boss in question goes, you have any marketing experience? I was like, no, not even a little bit. Like, I've purchased things because of marketing, but that's about it. And they're like, okay, well, we're gonna hire you for marketing. Okay. Because they were just getting started on their very first the very first Zombicide Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And they wanted somebody to be able to voice all of their commercials and internet spots and things like that. And that particular he told me, he goes, I really like your voice and I would like to use it. And so sure enough, I'm like, all right, well, I guess that's what's gonna have to happen. And they bought me some recording gear for the studio here at the house, and I recorded the first couple of Kickstarter commercials for like Zombicide, and I think the one after that that wasn't a Zombicide, but I mean, Wrath of Kings. I did. It was only about three or four Kickstarters that I did the voicing for before they started making enough money that they were like, all right, we're going to hire somebody who like this is their job completely, and then. It was shortly after that that they, you know, David Doust, the one of the owners, was he's like, well, it says here you've done some writing, and I was like, well, yeah, it, about a million words worth, you know, it's kind of why I came to you in the first place, and he was like, well, you know, we're looking at you know, starting to put a little more love into, you know, these game franchises, the miniature games. And so that was when I started just doing just a couple of little fiction paragraphs, little, you know, descriptions of character units. Basically the same kind of stuff that I was doing with Privateer back in the day. Now I was doing it for Dark Age. Mm-hmm. And then that was basically how the relationship began with that and Dark Age. And then over time it developed into a much larger role with the game. I left the company and then came back, and when I came back it became a very large role with the game. But yeah, it was not my original job there, but it was definitely what I wanted to do. It was what I came knocking on the door to do was basically to write for Dark Age, because that was what Kevin Clark, a former friend of mine that worked with me at Privateer, who was working at CMON at the time, told me that they needed a writer for Dark Age, and that was why I needed to come knock on the door. And then it turned into the whole voiceover thing and whatnot. But yeah, I came to them going, one of your employees says I need to try and get a job here to write for Dark Age. And they were like, well, how about you do voiceovers instead? Mm-hmm. But then eventually it turned into Dark Age. And that was once I got into that world, when I got into Adder and decided that this was a really cool setting that could be expanded on, you know, exponentially, it became one of my favorite places to write from.
Nice. So just so people know, in terms of the Dark Age releases, you know, off the top of your head, do you remember what you did the writing for and what you did the like game design for?
My first design where I was really given kind of not free reign, but where I had a lot more input on what was being created. Mm-hmm. Was the latter half of part of it was the Slavers and the Kukulkani, like right in that era. was like the first stuff where I was able to start like just designing and writing kind of at the same time. From there on out, or from there previously, like the Forsaken book and a couple of the Bounty Hunters, that kind of stuff, that was mostly just fiction. I was just creating storyline elements and describing units and kind of patching them together and stuff. I didn't get to really start flexing my design muscles until I think it was the Kukulkani was where that was the first time that I really kind of got to show off how to make things.
Nice. And that was the like Fanatic magazine initial release of the Kukulkani.
Yep, that was. Nice. I remember when David Dowse came to us. We were standing. It was after hours at a Gen Con, and there was just a pile of us at the booth, and we were all standing around. And he goes, "Oh, hey, I've got an idea. I need to show you some stuff." And I was like, "Okay." And so he pulled up an art portfolio on his phone and like kind of like started scrolling through a bunch of these, you know, space Aztec images. And I was like, "Dude, this is awesome." And he goes, "Yeah." He's like, we want these guys to come out with the, in, you know, December 12, 2012, you know, this is the end of the world. We're going to hype them up. So we need to get these guys designed and done and models ready. You know, we've got some time, but let's you have a legitimate deadline. Like that needs to happen. And so we decided to have it on Ravage magazine. The December issue, so to speak, was where the K3 originally popped out. And then of course they, you know, got, some book love later on, but.
Sorry. You're right. Yeah. Sorry. I said Fanatic, but I meant Ravage. Thank you for the correction there. That's awesome. And then I know you were really like, into the design towards the end of the game. In fact, you did the 2017 rules and a lot before that, up until the kind of last releases, right?
Yeah. No, pretty much from that point forward, there was a moment where Michael Chennault got basically called away to do mostly board games and initially start working on Song of Ice and Fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that time that myself and Dave Taylor, who was a conscript for lack of a better term, he was definitely a freelance voice of awesomeness. That Doust sat the two of us down. We all of us went down to Georgia. He sat the two of us down, and Dave laid out this big proposal of, we're going to bring Dark Age back. We're going to make this two-player. We're going to make this two-player starter set. We're going to, you know, this is going to be the resurrection that this game deserves. And we had plans, like giant cardboard, like cutout stands that were like initial marketing packages for stores. If a store wanted to buy into Dark Age, is like, you know, here's this for this X amount thing, you get the stand, you get the posters, you get, you know, this much product. Like it was, we had really, Dave Taylor and myself had worked out a very detailed, way to do this, but it required us to, we had to redo the packaging. There was no way. The old blisters just didn't, you could not do a new store level launch without new packaging. At the exact same time, unbeknownst to us, there was a management change at CMON that brought on a new sales head, basically a guy in charge of the entire sales department, and he had some different ideas on how things were going to happen. So the plan that we had put together with Doust didn't get executed quite in the way it was intended. There was some miscommunications about what needed to get done first and foremost, but yet we also still needed to keep pushing forward on models because we at that point we were really starting to see some steam. You know, we were starting to see some more people showing up for tournaments, conventions that were selling out of product. You know, we were starting to see all the signs of, oh, hey, this, you know, we're doing really good. Let's keep going. But unfortunately, what that also did is that it continued to take away our focus from fixing the old product. So you can only fix so much old stuff and put out new stuff before one of those sides starts to drag behind. And so that was where we really started focusing on, you know, the new feel. And that was where the 2017 rules came out, because it was that 2017 rules were going to be the larger version of what came in the two-player starter kit. And the two-player starter kit was going to be the headline of any of these store sets that you buy. We started introducing the OP kits, where the stores could buy. Those were super popular. Mm-hmm. And then that's really what I would consider to be what the golden age of Dark Age was, is where there were stores that wanted product and we just couldn't produce it fast enough. You know, it was either packaging or product or something else that kept getting in our way. But Dark Age was definitely on the rise when it came to, you know, independent skirmish level miniature game.
Can you think of like a favorite moment that you had during the development?
Absolutely. I would say when I my favorite moment was probably when Dave and I went to Coleraine, Ireland, to film with the Beasts of War guys. I made some, we filmed a bunch of Dark Age videos and some Wrath of Kings videos while we were there. So that was definitely a very cool moment for the game, because, we were going to Atlanta and filming, you know, battle reports and stuff. And that's always cool, because, you know, I watch battle reports every week for different games, like on my, mm-hmm. on my extra screen. So it was neat to be part of that process and see it from behind the cameras. But also I made some very good friends over there, and I'm still kicking myself that, you know, because of this stupid pandemic and stuff, I haven't been able to get over there and see them. I'm hoping that by the time Warzone kicks off and does really well, that maybe I'll be able to talk Alex into heading over there and recording some video with them, because I would love to see those guys again. So that would probably be the highlight of that, those, especially those first few years. But when it comes to like as a professional moment, it would probably be when the fabrication company in China sent me the first run of the Path to Glory starter box. I remember Doust, basically, I called him up and it was like, hey, I've got this box sitting on my desk. What do you want me to do with it? And he was honest. He's like, you're in charge of Dark Age now. You're the manager of that line. You need to go through and make sure everything's up to snuff and let them know if anything needs changed. And as up until that point, purely a freelance professional, occasionally a staff writer, I had never had that kind of decision sitting on my desk before. And so I sat down and I went through all the parts, and I went through the, you know, tensile strength on the plastics, and went ahead and glued everything together and got everybody on their bases, and realized that we were missing 30 health counters. And it was an eye-opening moment, because it was definitely one of those things where I was like, I'm not just working for the game. I am making this game. Like if I decided right now that one of these models was wrong, it would cost the company a bunch of money, but I could make that call. Like, I could change what needs to be changed right now. And it was definitely sobering, and it was definitely you are more to this line than you thought you were. Some people call it imposter syndrome, where you're working at something and you're like, I'm not really doing this. You know, like, that's not really the case. That happened a lot to me in those first couple months of being the brand manager for Dark Age, is, you know, when I'm ordering tens of thousands of cards from China, or I'm calling up, you know, the sculptors and being like, hey, I sent you an art brief. I need greens. Mm-hmm. This, it was just not something that I had ever done before. And realizing, like, really kind of coming to terms with the fact that the game was being made at my say so, was a super cool moment. Not to pat myself on the back or anything, but it was definitely like, you have in our industry, it's often pretty thankless, you know, I don't want people to be like, oh, poor writer guy. You know, more often than not, the wages aren't great. Yeah. But you're doing a labor of love. And it was moments like that, that I went, holy shit, I'm doing it. Like this, you know, this is not a job. You know, I don't have to worry about tomorrow waking up and going, oh, hey, I gotta go punch a clock. I was like, no, I'm doing this. This is my career now. And nice. that was probably one of the coolest moments, was seeing this lots of zeros at the end of it project ending up on my desk and asking my boss, what do I do with it? And he's like, well, what do you do with it? And it just, David Doust is an amazing guy and will always be one of those people that I attribute my mental success in this career to, because not only was he a really good friend, and I say was, like, as if, you know, he's passed, he's not, we just don't talk as much as we used to. Remember that David Doust guy? You know, not only did we just get along as friends and like as coworkers, he really did put in me the confidence that I needed to take the steps. And even now, you know, I'm back to being freelance for lots of different companies, but my negotiation tactics now are completely different. When I negotiate a contract, it's utterly different. I'm not afraid to put in non-compete or to fight against non-compete clauses, or at least aspects of them. And I owe all that to the dark age days, is really what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome, man. So when you were working on Dark Age, did you have a favorite piece of fiction that you wrote? Any favorite characters or any favorite models that you worked on?
Yeah, I think so. I loved any time that I was able to write for any of the Dragiri personalities. I love writing inhuman. Where people just don't think like us. I love writing from that standpoint, where, you know, the world is different. Or if any time that I have a chance to write two pieces of the same scene but from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Like I was able to write the Dragiri half of the Saint Mark conflict, mm-hmm. where, you know, from Mark's perspective is these monsters coming over the hill. And from the Dragiri perspective, they're like, what are these horrible little parasites on our planet? You know, what is that cute thing they have? Oh God, he set one of our guys on fire. Sinner, you know, like dishonorable little cur, you know, like I love getting to take a look at the same thing from a different perspective. And if I get an opportunity to write both halves, that's definitely one of my favorites, is to be able to try and show both sides of the mirror, so to speak. But yeah, that's probably one of my favorite pieces, is the ice cast side of the St. Mark confrontation. My favorite character? Oh man, that's hard. That's a hard one, because there are so many good ones. Like, there's a lot of very deep people. I'm going to say that it was probably the beginning of, you didn't get to see the final downfall of it, sadly. But the beginning of St. Joan's fall, where she finds out that, St. Techno guy, I can't remember his name for life. Isaac. Thank you. Where she finds out that Isaac is one of many.
Yep.
And it's no longer, you know, it's one of those, I was falling in love with a clone, like, and he pops out and he's just, I'm good, man. Who's this crazy broad? You know, like, get out of my face, crazy lady. You know, that was probably one of my favorite interactions. And the whispers of her darkness in her head. The fact that, you know, we were, there was no question. You were watching her fall over the edge. I really wanted people to see her. She, you know, again, her saint, you know, she's the saint of the Phoenix, and, you know, the model that she was going to get was phenomenal, risen up on Phoenix wings, and all, oh, Rassum frassum. But the story to accompany that is Dark Ages was always so dark, no pun intended, but it was always, you know, everything's a downer. You know, very rarely does anything good happen to anybody. Joan was eventually going to, like, she was going dark Joan. Like, there was definitely a Dark Phoenix Joan going to happen where, yeah, no, I don't mind burning my own people to death if it means killing the enemy. You know, like, no question there. But there was going to be a redemption, or basically a redemption arc for her, where like a true Phoenix, she comes out on the other side as one of the Forsaken's poster children for It's Not All Bad.
Right on.
And I really wish we would have made it there, but
so I'll pivot that to kind of one of my open questions. So let's say you came into all the money in the world. You play the lottery tonight and you win it all. And after buying DC Comics, you decide to buy Simon and take over Dark Age. So hypothetically, if you took over from where the game left off story-wise and you had to finish up the open arcs, how would you finish those off?
Oh, wow. Wow. That's a great question. I would follow the path that we were heading down. The Brood would have been the next big installment, where you get the patriarch of the Brood kind of has his own little happy family, causing a bunch of ruckus down in the Southwest. The Kukulkani would go into their full on civil war, which that actually was already statted out. Like, we had lists of models, what was going to be the difference between, you know, because everybody goes through civil wars, you know, yeah, the Dragiri fight against themselves. Oh, now look, the Brood are fighting against themselves. We wanted it to be a little different in the way that it's not different factions. It was, there were going to be a handful of models. And I think, if I remember correctly, we released a couple of them that had some of those first traits.
I think we only got the one type hinting at it, the special 75-point warrior that had like a sun side and a moon side.
Oh, okay, yeah. Basically, what was going to happen is there was going to be a handful of models that were for one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And by handful, I mean like two or three. And then there were going to be cards for both sides for every other model in the force.
Nice.
So there would be a lunar Cabrican and a solar Cabrican. There would be lunar warriors and there would be solar warriors. And then there was like two models that were eclipse warriors that basically their card didn't change. They fought for both sides.
Okay.
And the way that it worked was you basically, when you picked your side, those are the cards that you drew from as far as all of your different different models and whatnot, and they had different rituals, they had different, like, it effectively made two armies out of one army.
Okay.
Without us having to relaunch the entire line. Yeah. Because that was a big thing, is that we didn't want to have to be like, okay, here's a whole new set of moon warriors, here's a whole new set. We wanted to be able to introduce just a handful of models, but give people an opportunity, if they're a K3 player and they're like super into the Kukulkani, if they wanted to, they could paint one of their new squads as the moon cult. Or, you know, maybe they put together this army list as moon cult and they switch out a couple of models and bam, now you're playing the solar cult. And so that was going to be the next big launch. And then throughout the intersprinkling, the more and more of the Earth cast was going to wake up until eventually we had all of their list all out and ready to go. But as far as storyline goes, the big overarching thing is, and from this is just a me personal belief when it comes to designing a war game, is you never end your story.
Mm-hmm.
You never put an actual like apocalypse at the end of something. You know, because that really does spell the end of your game. You know,
yeah.
you don't want to be like, okay, boop, and it's done. The goal was basically keep everybody fighting. you know, everybody either fighting between themselves or amongst each other. But one of the big storyline moments is we if you go back to the story about the where the Grand Arbiter was announced, where Yavanka became the Grand Arbiter, the floating stones, the stone circles that they were at, there was a heavy allusion there that there was more to those stones. They, you know, there was like magic in them, so to speak. You know, they're very Xenosethic. You know, there was a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, all the madness that's happening down in the Brood, down with the Brood, the fact that a bunch of those Xenoshift monsters were coming to life here in Dark Age, we were going to eventually have the you call him the Patriarch, but that's not his name.
The Father?
He is the Father, but it's the there's an actual, he actually had a model, he had a figure. What's he?
Progeny Prime?
Yes, thank you. Because I was trying to figure out what the hell his name was. So that critter, he's, you know, the embodiment of the Father, was eventually going to cross paths with some of those Earthcast, which we know are heavily Xenosethic. You know, they have got a lot of crystal love, and what that was going to do is that was basically going to give it was going to give Progeny Prime a reason to march out of the swamps.
Okay.
Because it was going to be, I know the power that mineral actually can do. And the point was to eventually get him up to the circle, the standing stones.
Mm-hmm.
And if let out basically a psychogenic kind of cry, a call out to the stars, if you will. And that was going to put, in the greater scope of things, that was going to put Adder back on the map.
Okay.
Is that all of these, planets or planet inner interplanetary spaceships and stuff floating back and forth, they've stayed away from here for a long time because all of the communication satellites have been dead for ages. Anyone who comes near here, just like Flay's ship, you know, it gets too close, it gets drawn into the planet's gravity well and crashes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no reason to come here because there was no navigational way of doing so. With Progeny Prime activating this circle of stones, it would basically create kind of a ping on everybody's map, and it would give us an opportunity to introduce humans from outside, humans that might come back and say, "Hey, we're sorry." You know, like, you know, first it trickle them in, you know, like the first ship that gets here, it's, you know, scouts and things, and then they find out, you know, there are humans on this planet, and one of, you know, somebody like Isaac or somebody fills them in and says, "Hey, so this is what's going on. This is what you left us with, you dicks." And technology has gotten so good for them that they're able to go ahead and send a message and go, "Hey, there's more to the story than just the energy signature." And that would give us a kind of a jumping off point to potentially create, to potentially bring in more from outside, rather than we had really felt that the factions had kind of gotten to their bursting point. You know, how you can't really invent new saints every time. and when it comes to like the Dragiri, we had been talking about the Earthcast for ages. So you can't really just so, "Oh, and the new cast that you didn't know about that, but they've always been there," is, you know, yep. Like you have to start introducing from outside of the world, or at least outside of what you've written so far. And the only stuff about Adder that we had written about that were not really there would be the Altegrins, but the whole point of the Altegrins is that they were dead.
Yep.
And it would be very weird to bring them back in, because then it's just like, "Oh, here's a bunch of high-tech Dragiri." It's kind of like Firecast, except better. You know, like, it just, it, 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 that just seemed weird. So that was the overall general direction. And not to mention, you know, the Kuatli, or the Kuatel, they've made some enemies. You know, they've raked over quite a few planets. It would have given us an opportunity that, you know, like maybe when the human military shows up, when you get an actual Terran faction, they show up and go, oh, we know these guys. We've clashed with them before. And now you've got, you know, the Forsaken that are like, oh, please, gods, tell us how to deal with it. You know, they're draining our people in the fields. You know, they're literally eating our bioenergy in front of us. Oh, my gosh, please tell us that you've beaten them. You know, like,
yep.
And so that was, again, more than many years worth of pushing forward. But initially, it would have been the Brood, and then the K3 and the Earthcast would have gotten their all of their love.
Nice. So I'll ask kind of my fanboy question, and then we bring it more to General Driss stuff. So in the Scarred book, it looked like we were setting up a plot against Johan. Did you have any thoughts on how that was going to go down?
So I was being pushed by outside forces, narratively, to potentially kill Johan.
Okay.
I did not want to kill him. He is too popular of a character. He has a historic version. He has a current version. Everybody and their brother loves Johan. What I figured was going to happen is he was going to get backstabbed by Decay and Shadow, kind of collectively. They were gonna backstab him with the help of blood, which I'm pretty sure that was written on the wall. That blood was done being everybody's whipping boy at this point. And what my eventual solution was going to be is, since we've already got two versions of Johan, why not make a third? And it was going to be a scarred generic, basically he gets injured to the point of, oh, you're lying there in pieces, and Mayhem slaps him into an abomination.
Okay.
So you would get a Johan abomination. again, it may have started out as a joke, but then turned into something more. So what I wanted was, you know, Johan at his brain, you know, brain dead. He's basically just it's almost like Mayhem makes an agreement with the others, makes an agreement with Mommy Blazin, and says, we don't tell anybody what happened in here. We just say that he has elevated himself to a new level. They don't need to know that it's our voice talking through the speaker. They don't need to know that he's basically just a meat puppet in this box. And so the Scarred would still be technically following him, following Johan's say-so, but effectively he was just going to be sort of a meaty radio for a collection of others to talk through him.
Right on. That is bleak. Chris, you want to get any your questions in?
Yeah, so much goes into the Old Ma and St. Mark story. Like, you have all those little bits and pieces sprinkled in, but I don't think I ever saw. Why doesn't Old Ma like St. Mark?
So I did not write. So unfortunately, Eric Kelly was the one that wrote that initial interaction. So you would have to ask Eric on where it came from. Where I decided eventually it was going to was Old Ma is obviously, she is of an older mentality of people take care of people. You know, it's if you get into, if I let you in my door, I'm gonna cook you some soup. You're gonna sit down. You're gonna have a good time. You know, like, where I've let you in my house, I'm going to take care of you, you're my responsibility. Whereas Mark is more of a, you're going to let me in your house, you're going to feed me, I'm probably going to make out with your daughter, and I'm going to be gone before noon. Is that cool? And we get a little hint of, she was there taking care of him when he was injured. And I was trying to allude to the fact that his ungratefulness his lack of gratitude is really what set her off. Is the, you know, you're supposed to be a saint, you're supposed to be taking care of people, and you are the embodiment of selfishness.
Yep, that's a fair summary, Em.
Whether or not it was supposed to go any deeper than that, I never got any notes from Eric or anything like that. If it was supposed to be, they have familial connections or anything like that, and I never read that any deeper into that. I really just took it as when Mark was on death's door, old Ma helped save him, and there was never a thank you. So she basically wrote him off as that guy's a giant dick.
All right. That's entirely too reasonable for Dark Age. I don't accept it.
So, on a completely different note, you know, as somebody who is deeply, deeply arachnophobic, why? What is the deal with the Shadowcast and all of the spiders?
Well, the Shadowcast, honestly, so when it comes to the spiders themselves, those were artistic choices that were made while I was not with the company.
like send the hate mail somewhere else.
So what I was told, because basically when I came in for the Dragiri book, they were like, all right, we're making a shadow cast. I said, hell yeah, that's awesome. And they said, and it's going to include these 12 models. And I said, that's weird. I was like, why these models? It's like, well, cause we've already paid for the art and here are the resins of like the first six. And I'm like, oh, okay, so this is done. Like, all right, well, what are they? And they're like, well, they've got some names based off of what the artist called them. That's it. I didn't get a whole lot of, there was not really much else when it came to the Dragiri book. They were just like, okay, here's what we've been told up until now. And so what we were doing is basically we had to come up with a reason why these spiders replaced the slaves. Why there aren't spear slaves, sling slaves, and shard slaves for the Shadowcast. And Our big thing with that was because the Shadowcast, they are so old. You know, they are that kind of Illuminati where, like, even the young ones know the old tales because they've been living in darkness and talking to each other, each other, and listening to whispers. It was that these guys remember the Altegrans. They remember... Okay. They remember what it was like being slaves, and they're obviously with their newfound powers and their new manipulation of the world around them. They are sure as hell not going back to be slaves. So they don't even want to risk having the Altegran stock near them. So that's why there are no slaves in the Shadowcast, but because they are master manipulators and things, they need something to basically do all the menial tasks. So they just psychogenically control the creatures from below. I was planning on adding worms, like basically subterranean versions of the drill head, the Zwei, except without basically with their regular mouths instead of having any bionic parts. There was going to be a lot more of that, and then the art came in for the Umbra Elemental, and it was. Oh, okay. So these guys are full on nightmare beasts. Okay. Here we go. There was plans to create lesser Umbras.
Nice.
The lesser Umbras were basically shapeshifters. So their model set was almost going to be like you buy a box and it's got five in there, and one looks like a Forsaken, one looks like a Scar, like kind of like what we did with the Decay zombies. Mm-hmm. Except imagine like T-1000s, but instead of metal, like liquid metal, it's my arms turning into this giant shadow claw.
Hmm.
And they were all going to have insane assassin. Like their stats themselves were not great. They weren't like you looked at them and go, that's a lesser elemental. They were more offensive versions of like almost like embers.
Okay.
Except the points you paid for them allowed you to sort of when an enemy model of that base size is injured but not killed,
you step in.
You can basically make a power check and go, he wasn't actually He wasn't actually Ted the Slaver. He was one of my Umbra. Bloop.
Nice. I like it. That sounds brutal.
It was a really neat mechanic that we were starting to work with, and it went hand in hand with you know how there's David, the ice cast guy, and then we made an air cast version with Mackenzie's guy.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
There was going to be a box that had one for everybody.
Oh, nice.
Because that was actually going to be, storyline-wise, the Grand Arbiter was going to require it. Basically, she was going to, with the exception of the Shadow, because they refuse, she was going to step forward and say, we need to start connecting with the other people on this planet, or the life-siphoning K3 are going to kill the whole thing. And so the goal was, there was going to be an Earthcast guy. There was going to be basically humans that are almost like an ambassador.
Okay.
And so that was going to be a box set at some point, and the ambassadors would be suspiciously devoid of a Shadowcast ambassador. And then at that same release wave, there would be the box of like three to five lesser Umbras.
Nice. Speaking of Shadowcast, so in the Jagiri book, we know that Yavanka and Amabalia fought to be the Arbiter, but we don't actually see the fight. Was that fight scene ever planned to be released, or was that intentionally kind of left to be picked up in Media Res?
I think that was because they are so identical when it comes to, with the exception of a couple of spells here and there.
Yep.
Having it happen off camera was a way for us to, or off page as the case may be, was a way for us to basically say the fight happened. And this is, you know, we, rather than having, you know, 10 pages dedicated to the two of them throwing fans at each other, you know, throwing spells at each other, you know, it would be such a, because they are such a mirrored force,
mm-hmm.
it would be very repetitious. So it was easier for us to say, okay, the fight's going to begin, and then, oh, hey, the fight ended. Okay. Now, if there was ever going to be some like foul play or something like let's say down the road, we decided that we were going to introduce some nasty Firecast sniper or something that like, which I'm, that's not actually saying that we did. I'm just saying like, let's say we were going to, and he had, you know, had his sights on that fight the whole time. You know, or something along those lines. We may have alluded to it at some point, but it was not something that was ever planned to be put onto paper, just because it would be, I don't want to say boring, but
repetitive. Yeah. I get what you're saying. So I actually had a couple of questions on kind of where the background was like around the Apocalypse time frame versus where it ended up closer to the 2017 time frame. And I totally understand if your answer to these is, I don't know, wasn't involved.
some of it's going to be,
So in the original like Exodus book, there were allusions to a Father Retribution who was in charge of all the Scarred, and in particular for the Toxic Cult, a Grandfather Ast who kind of knocked Kerwin around. Where did those characters go in the background?
I thought we wrote Asp out in the actual Scarred book.
Yep. Oh, okay. Actually, that totally was a thing. I remember that battle scene. It was awesome.
Yeah, okay. we did Asp.
Okay.
Retribution, I thought Johan killed him during an event that Michael ran at Gen Con.
Oh, well, there you go.
Because he did the Walls of Retribution, that big giant event where everybody fought against his enormous Scarred army.
Okay.
I could have swore the narrative end to that was, if you guys win, Retribution dies, and the bad guys and the good guys won.
Got it. Okay. I thought the bad guys won at that, but I was wrong.
You know what? I could be wrong. I was, like I said, at that point, I was just getting my feet wet when it came to working for Simon. So I don't know for sure. Asp, I know we dealt with. We wrote him into the Scarred book. Yeah.
Okay. I'm embarrassed to say I missed that. So at the end of Dark Age Evolution, St. John is being covered with brood and slowly being nom nom nommed. Did you guys just kind of walk away from that as a point in the background? Did you have any idea how he got action? What were your thoughts there?
So the only thing that I know is when this was brought up, this was there was a second. So I have a feeling, and this is just a, because it was before my time, mm-hmm. I have a feeling that St. John's nom 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 was supposed to be what turned him into who became St. Luke.
Okay. Okay.
I have a feeling that St. Luke was supposed to be St. John.
Got it.
Interesting.
And instead of it becoming an evolution of an existing saint, it became a new saint with a very similar story.
Okay. That makes some interesting sense.
That's merely a guess. I don't know. No one ever said anything. But it does seem like in the chronology of the game, roughly about the same time that Luke appears is when John got nommed.
So I'm going to throw the gauntlet down. I'm calling that official canon. If Simon wants to correct me and also answer some other questions about Dark Age, they're welcome. So there's a lot of allusions in the background to the Bible. Particularly in context of the Forsaken, but we see in a couple of books that there's some quotes in there from like the Art of War. And it's never really been clear if that's the current understanding of what we would call the Bible or if that was something else. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So the original Forsaken text, the actual text that the council came forward and said, we need to create a religion or our people are going to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
Is a collection of surviving books from the past.
Okay.
So there is nothing that says that the actual Forsaken Bible might not have a chapter in it about Neverland. there could be a whole subsection that discusses. You know what? If I had the opportunity, there could be a whole section that talks about, you know, Saint Snyder and how he rewrote history. You know, it is so open-ended what's actually in that Bible because most of these people couldn't read. So it came down to what the council, what the prevailers, what they said was in this giant tome. And that's why there are quotes from Sun Tzu in there. There is definitely there's some Buddhist Zen stuff in there. It just comes down to what survived the Exodus and what they were able to compile together to create a powerful enough book that would allow them to say this is the word of the creator.
Okay. Right on. Interesting.
I do like the idea of a St. Peter Pan.
I'm pretty sure Rom wrote a book about that, and it went to some dark places. So speaking of people that magically appear in the night, the Grey Lady, what was going on with her?
To be fair, that was an Eric Kelly creation, and I have no idea. I had no plans for her.
Got it. Grey Lady equals St. Peter Pan. If you want to correct me, Simon, come on.
There you go. I thought she was cool insofar that it was somebody who could kind of help Joan get her head on straight.
Mm-hmm.
But because she was such a militant Yoda that I couldn't find a way to put her in anywhere that made any more sense than I'm just a badass soldier chick that looks after Joan to make sure that Joan doesn't lose her brain. Because obviously it couldn't be any of Joan's legitimate family,
mm-hmm.
because they're all super dead as part of Joan's story. You know, so like when it came to the Grey Lady, I thought she was an interesting character that didn't necessarily need tied to anything else. I'm sure when we would have developed Crazy Jane or Crazy Joan more and got more into the evolution of Joan as a saint, we would have definitely had to look more at her just for the sheer fact that because she is a personality within the army, you can't, it's like, if we would have ever gone back and looked deeper at John, his standard bearer guy needs to be, is it John or Luke who has a standard bearer?
John.
Okay. I was right. You know, we couldn't just leave him behind. You know, you gotta, every once in a while, you gotta remind people, hey, that guy's still alive. And the Gray Lady would have been in a similar situation. We would have had to remind the forces that, hey, she's around. No one dies of old age in this game. I'm sure something tragic would, I would have been talked into something tragic happening to her, but on the surface, I really had no plans at the time.
Right on. Chris, you got anything else?
Nope, that was most, I think we hit almost all of mine.
Yeah, so we normally do three questions we ask. I'm gonna do another one called Who Would Win in a Fight? So I'm going to give you three options, or three scenarios. So who would win in a fight, John Carter or Jake Flay?
Does John have all his memories?
Let's go with yes.
John.
Who would win in a fight, John Carter or Chris Weinstein?
John Carter.
I agree.
Who would win in a fight, Zack Snyder or Josh Whedon?
Oh God, Snyder! Have you seen him?
Yes.
Like that's not even me being biased because I love his work. The dude is cut. He worked out with Henry Cavill during the Man of Steel. Like he's the dude is buff.
Yeah.
And Joss Whedon is just a sexist bag of gore. Sorry. But yeah, I know it was supposed to be kind of a funny question, but the Jake Flay, John Carter question, that was going to be a very cool moment for Carter. I don't normally want to evolve Immortals models unless they win a second time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going to have to for him because of the Flay storyline when what's her face? The scarred, the bounty hunter that works for the Scarred and has a monster with her,
Susie Bell.
Thank you. When Bell gets, there's a scene where Bell talks to John and basically is like, "What do you mean you don't know who that guy is?" Because John has forgotten who Flay is. He's familiar, but it's on the tip of his tongue, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, Bell, her whole plan is basically, one of the things that she was planning, because she's trying to get her revenge on Flay for leaving her on the ship to die, which, you know, that's probably pretty okay reasoning. That's
good motivation.
Well, that's decent motivation. Well, she was going to use John because she's like, if there's ever a person who can, you know, go after him and basically now make Flay's life hell here is, you know, Sheriff John Carter. You know, and so the whole point is Bell was going to sort of capture John and beat him and electrocute him. And it was going to be a horrible scene full of, you know, nasty psychogenic torture. And why does she work for the Scarred? Well, because they've got guys that can get into your brain and move things around. And the whole point was to eventually wake John up and activate all of his stuff. One of the things that John has in his person, we explained a little bit of it. We talk about how far he jumps and, you know, that he's strong. He's stronger than even he knows. We allude to that. There's more to John than what's on paper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Basically, he's got a whole body full of non splicing style bionics. Like he's got legitimately Terran bionics that he doesn't know how to use because it's not active. It's all just basically, you know, I push open this door for as hard as I need to push open this door. When I punch a guy, it's harder than normal, but you know, I don't need to punch him really hard because I'm just punching. And one of the things that basically gets woken up is his combat computer that it allows him to. That's why I asked is he at full power or no? Because when he's at full power, it allows him to do things like, oh, your muscles are tensing on the left side. You're going to swing at me to the right. He's very, very much like almost like a Sherlock computer or Sherlock Holmes computer inside John's head.
Got it.
So yeah, there was going to eventually be an epic version of John where he just forgoes the shotgun altogether
And just punches people to death.
Well, because the technology on such that weapon, it could backfire. So why would I use it?
Makes sense.
Yeah, the logic behind it is, yeah, it gives me a ranged weapon, or I could just throw a rock at you.
Fair.
So he would have like basically hurled projectiles, throwing like all of those things where you look at and go, why doesn't everybody throw knives? Why doesn't everybody throw like a ball bearing the size of a racquetball? Well, because most people don't have the strength to do that. John, when he's fully active, would. So yeah, there was going to be an epic John at some point, to borrow a term from another game, but that would have been at least one book away, because we would have had to have the, you know, fiction wise, there'd have to be the big story, the big narrative moment of Belle capturing him and having her scarred friends playing in his brain soup, and then at the end of that story, the big cliffhanger would be, you know, he breaks out of his bonds and could eat, like wipes the room with everybody and is like getting ready to finish her off and goes, this is, you know, this is me saying thank you, and like leaving her there just broken and being like, I have other, you know, there are other fish to fry on this planet, so this is my way of saying thank you for getting me to where I am. And then he goes bounding out the wall. Boing, 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 boing. So
wow,
there you go.
Nice.
Give you a hint of the madness of where things were going to go. And I hope John listens to your podcast, because then maybe you know what, you should send it to him and go, fast forward to the end. It's important for you.
I will. I actually haven't talked to him in a while. It's a good point. I should reach out. I think he'll get a kick out of this, and it'd be good just to say hi to him. He's good people. But I don't want to keep you all night. We definitely could go all night, but I don't want to mix 4 hours of audio, and I don't think
no problem. Anyway, there's more to this if you want. You know, I love being on microphone, and I love talking to you guys. I miss you guys from the convention scene, so this is a way for us to make it happen.
Awesome. Well, thank you,
very
Brian.
True.
All right. So on that note, I'm Owen.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Brian.
This is the Board Gamer Society. Peace.
Intro music is Axe to Mouth by Pulp 45, which is Owen's old band. Outro music is Control My Fate by Ataraxia, which is Chris's old band. All songs used with permission. If you like what you hear, please like or subscribe. Thanks.
That's fantastic. And that's the best way to do like 80s level coke and not kill yourself.